Many people think that children's books are, or should be, simple, given to pastels and primary colors, certainly not to complex ideas. And it seems that just as many people think that poetry is hard, given very much to complex notions and filled with more shadow than light. Lucille Clifton is an award-winning writer of both children's literature and poetry. Her works are rich and complex and filled with color and some shadow and light. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. Today we'll talk with Lucille Clifton about poetry, about children's books, and about the writing of both. Stay with us. You know, I want to start, mm-hmm. I want to spend a lot of time today talking about poetry and about children's books, but I want to start with something you wrote about, someone you wrote about in your memoir called Generations. Her name is Caroline Donald. Mm-hmm. And you describe her as a Dahomey woman.
Yes.
Now, I know that Dahomey is a West African country we call Toga, mm-hmm. but that's not what Dahomey woman means.
And also, that's not where Dahomey was when she was brought here. It was, I think the country now is called Benin. It was in that area since the continent was carved up in varying ways at varying times. But there's something about being a Dahomey woman that is special. And in looking into the culture of those people, among the Yoruba people, she said, they were people for whom who felt that women were very special, and who felt something of the spirit of the people passed through women. My father used to, among the things my father used to say to me all the time was, "You can do what you want. You are a Dahomey woman." I went for that. You know,
oh,
it
yeah.
was easy. And I think Carolyn Donald, though I certainly never knew her. But something about her spirit, I think, was obviously the spirit of a survivor and the spirit of someone who was from a long line and who was only part of a line that continued. I, with my four daughters and two sons, feel very much a Dahomey woman, I think.
Carolyn David was your, Donald was your great-great-grandmother.
Is that right? Well, she was my, I think something like that. She was my father's great-grandmother.
Great-grandmother.
And she was very new on this, that part of my family was very new on this continent, since she was not brought here until 1830, which is not a long time ago. And she remembered, she died in 1910. So she, my father, who was born in 1902, remembered her well. He was a man of phenomenal memory. And remembered what she said to him and the kind of stories that she spoke.
You grew up with stories all around.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Very fortunate to grow up listening to the stories. And nowadays, quite often, children only hear their parents instruct them. But I listened, like a lot of women of my kind, my generation, listened to the stories and remembered. I think it's very important to pass them on.
Reviewers of, especially of your poetry and early poetry, have said that at least two themes run strong in your work. One is that image of the strong fighting woman righting mm-hmm. the wrongs that have been done. And the other is the image of the woman who, while she fights, gives birth to and loves fiercely her own children. Is that a very strong theme in your own life?
I think, now, I don't know. Other people always tell you what your themes are. I have
right.
no idea what my themes are, because they vary. They vary. My themes are the themes of a female African-American woman on this shore. And I am as complex as everybody else is, you know, and so I have varying themes at varying times. But for me, obviously, I have 6 children who are now adults, and they are central probably to my life. I have gone through a lot of changes in my life, as any human has. I like to think I write out of being human. Mm. I write out of my own life experience, and I too am blessed with a long memory. And I write trying to find in, this is in poetry, trying to find in that experience that place in where I am human. And I hope to meet other people in the place where they are human, and we can connect there. I have a sense of humor. I was blessed with a sense of humor, so that which probably kept me alive.
Keeps the balance.
I think so. Yeah. And I'm interested in balance. I'm interested in managing to overcome and in being tough. I have discovered that I'm tough. I think that's something you discover. You say it, you're born tough, but it's only when you've faced interesting things, interesting challenges, that you discover, well, I am. Boy, am I glad. What a relief.
Do you think real toughness has to be balanced with humor to survive, or it goes over that edge?
It's better if it does,
yeah.
Because it doesn't blight you. Bitterness is not something that one can stay with and remain the best that they are as a human being. Despair,
line.
You can't stay there. But then balance is extremely important. I think the law of the universe is balance. And I think the universe insists on it. And if one does not try to continually balance oneself, the universe balances one. What a drag. You know, it's much easier. It is really easier to try to continue doing it yourself.
Do it by volition. Mm-hmm. This is Conversations. We're talking today with Lucille Clifton. She is a writer of both children's literature and poetry. We'll talk about both in this time. I have read, again, that you have insisted that you didn't choose to be a poet.
No.
There's a line in a poem from the book Ordinary Woman, it's called Love Poem, that says, "Demon, demon, you have dumped me in the middle of my imagination. I will have you, have you, have you." Mm-hmm. Did the demon, so to speak, come and get you?
I think so. People ask, when did I decide to be a poet? I have never decided to be a poet. I have always loved language. I have always accepted poems that come to me. I've always remained open to the universe. I think it's Keats who said that to be a poet is not a profession, it is a condition. Huh. And I guess I've been in that condition all my life. If you choose it, it becomes a profession. But one of the dangers then is that it's more important to you to be a poet than to write poems. And I know a lot of students now who are very interested, I teach, who are very interested in being a poet, but less interested in writing poems. And the bottom line is that sometimes gets in the way of doing the best poetry that you can do.
Is that a question of stature rather than craft?
Yeah, something romantic they think about being a poet. You can go around wearing funny clothes, which you can, of course, but you need to have clear, why am I doing this? You know?
Lucille Clifton mentioned that she is a teacher. She teaches at St. Mary's College in Maryland. She's also taught at Coppin State University, at Goucher, at the American University in Washington, D.C., and at UC Santa Cruz, a number of other teaching appointments as well. We'll find out more about Lucille Clifton as we talk. When did you first, do you remember, I should ask, I suppose, when you first fell in love with words?
I don't really. I remember, I can remember the first thing that I read.
What was that?
Was The Citadel. A.J. Cronin. I had no idea what a citadel was. I had no idea about any of it, but I knew that the way these words ran together was wonderful. People ask about my literary antecedents. I think mine was very good preaching, because my parents devout, or my father at any rate, was a devout member of the Baptist Church, and it was a very oral tradition. And so my poetry comes from an oral tradition, in that the sound of language is important to me. But I think I always loved the role of language, done well, done interestingly, and the sound of the words and the music in the language. I think that the American language is very musical. Mm. And you can, after a certain point, you can feel the music in it, I think. At least I think I can.
Which you have written in your latest book of poetry called Quilting, a poem called, I think, let me find it here, The Beginning of Language, The Birth of Language. Would you read it for us?
These are, you know, everything means more than the words in the page. A poem is one of those things that is more than the sum of all its parts.
And that means what to you, more than the sum
means
of all
that
its parts?
That means that you can put the most simple, what seem to be the most simple words on paper, and they take on all kinds of other things, because language is like that. Words are not only their definition, but their baggage, their history, their resonance, their sound, their music. And so it's amazing how one puts these things down and they take on all kinds of added dimension, which is an interesting challenge to me. I've written a number of poems trying to figure out language. This is called The Birth of Language. And Adam rose fearful in the garden, without words for the grass his fingers plucked, without a tongue to name the taste shimmering in his mouth. Did they draw blood, the blades? Did it become his early lunge toward language? Did his astonishment surround him? Did he shudder? Did he whisper, Eve? I do a lot of stuff with Adam and Eve, that idea as well.
And I love the thought that it might have been love and it might have been pain that brought those first words.
Or both.
Or both.
You know, one of the things with language that's always interesting to me is that we, especially in the West, I think, tend to think because we call this table, that's its name. Because we call, I just saw moose, I'm very excited. Because we call it moose, we think it calls itself moose. You know, that's very odd to me.
And that the word moose embodies mooseness.
This, yes, right. Is moosedom. But it seems to me that I'm always conscious, and maybe this is the quirky thing, maybe this is the romantic poet strangeness, but I'm always conscious that because I call it moose, I do not know what it calls itself, nor do I know what it calls me. But because this is my language, this doesn't mean it's the only language.
This opens you constantly to a state of wonder.
Oh, yeah.
What is mooseness?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. What is mooseness? And then to think about mooseness, what do they see as humanness? Those people with no fur at all. I mean, it must be very interesting. No rack, nothing.
Talk to me more about language. Mm-hmm. There are many languages that we speak in this nation. There is what you have referred to as standard English.
Standard written formal English.
Yes.
The lingua franca of the country. But all of us speak more than one language. All of us speak more than one variety of English, because we all have casual languages. We all have languages that there's a language that we speak to our peers, one to our people who we regard as authorities, one to our loved ones, one to our children. We all have these. Now, there sometimes is a feeling that there is only one valid language, and it is standard written formal English, the language in which business is conducted. That is not it's not an oral tongue. It's not a spoken tongue particularly, though there are some people who speak it. And I think there is a tendency to believe that if you are educated, if you're smart, this is the only one you speak. It seems to me a mistake. All languages are languages about communicating, you know, and languages are all valid when used appropriately. This matters to me in children's literature particularly, because when I write people talking, I write them, or I attempt to write them, speaking the language that they would speak. This is artistically honest, I think. But I have received flack off and on from people who say those people aren't speaking correct grammar.
You're not being an appropriate model for the
yes,
children.
Yes, the children won't learn to spell. Well, I don't write spellers. And it's a false issue, you know. Yeah. The people, and often teachers, certainly not here, but other places, teachers who say they can't, they don't want to read this language to their children because it doesn't teach them how to speak correctly. But they read to their children Uncle Remus, they read Huck Finn, they read Tom Sawyer, they read Pecos Bill, they read lots of things. It's a false issue, I'm fairly sure.
There is another poem from mm-hmm. this same book mm-hmm. that is called Defending My
yes.
Tongue, that speaks to this issue.
Yes.
Also from Quilting. This mm-hmm. book has come out in 1991.
Yes, Quilting is just out. Defending My Tongue. What I be talking about can be said in this language only. This tongue be the one that understands what I be talking about. Are you talking about the landscape that would break me if it could, the trees my grandfolks swung from, the dirt they planted in and ate? No, what I be talking about, the dirt, the tree, the landscape can only be said in this language. The words be hard, be bumping out too much to be contained in one thin tongue, like this language, this landscape, this life. Because the life on this continent, the landscape on this continent, and the language are not one single thing and can't be said in one single way. I have a poem that talks about point of view. I was poet laureate of Maryland for some time, and fortunately, the governor and I understood that poets don't do assignments. We give assignments, but we don't do them. And so I didn't have to go around doing things, but for the 350th anniversary of the state, I tried to be a responsible human being, and I knew I should write a poem. And I did, but it was interesting because the theme of the 350th anniversary of Maryland was our happy colonial days. And I didn't have a lot of happy colonial days. I had maybe two, you know? And so I wanted to be, I mean, I am an honest woman and I'm not going to compromise my work, but how was I going to do this? And so I did write a poem that I think was valuable, but I wrote a little poem for me, which appeared then on buses, on part of something called, I forgot what it was called, but a lot of poems on buses. And it's called Why Some People Be Mad at Me Sometimes. And it's, they ask me to remember, but they want me to remember their memories. Mm. And I keep on remembering mine. Which is obvious, you know, one would think. And it's okay, too.
Once again, this is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes, your host for KUAC. We're talking today with Lucille Clifton. She has been twice nominated for a Pulitzer Prize.
Three times. Quilting has just been nominated for the Pulitzer.
It has just. Mm-hmm. Well, then we say and announce it here. Quilting has just been nominated, her third nomination for a Pulitzer Prize. The first two nominations were for Two-Headed Woman and for Good Woman, Poems and a Memoir, and at the same time, Next,
yes,
New
both
Poems.
Were nominated at the same
so
time.
Four of your books have been
yes,
nominated for
yes.
the Pulitzer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've wanted to talk to you about the importance of what you call the examined life. You write about it in a poem called For Joan or To Joan.
Oh, yes.
Joan of Arc.
Uh-huh.
And another one, it seems to me, also talks about it, called Wild Blessings. In both, in each, you say essentially that the voices you hear, people will tell you not to listen to. Your inner voices. Mm-hmm. People will tell you about your memories, what you should mm-hmm. remember, but that you must mm-hmm. find you in those voices mm-hmm. and bring it out. How did, this may feel like a specious question, I hope not, how did you, Lucille Clifton, begin to realize that your life must be examined? It's a very painful thing to have an examined
life.
Well,
I think one of the blessings, of one of the several blessings about being born a black woman in America was that one learns early not to buy other people's definitions. One learns early that what other people say about oneself and about the life that you see may not be accurate. And so I long ago learned that I have to define myself. I have to find me. And I have to also trust my own perceptions, as long as I try hard to keep them honest, which I do, about what life is about what being me is about what being human is about. And I think that I learned over a period of years to try to do that with some courage, if possible, as much as possible. I mean, who's courageous all the time, but once in a while.
It seems to me that there is a special place that people of color, people of other types of minorities in this country have, where they stand looking in as well as being in. And I wonder if that gives an artist a special perspective from which to view her society.
I think maybe. That I have a book called Two-Headed Woman, and there are a couple of ways of looking at things. One is always there and watching, I think, and paying attention, which is what any artist has to do. I think everyone could do it, but there is a kind of mythology in the country, and it tends to be a mythology that doesn't include minority people, so we don't have to deal with it, you know. So the country doesn't surprise us, which I think is very, which is very lucky, because I think for other artists sometimes their art even comes from their surprise at what in fact they discover about themselves and others. I don't think we have to go through that. I think I tell my classes this all the time. I never took creative writing courses. I never took that sort of thing. So there's a lot I did not have to unlearn. There's a lot I came directly learned myself. One of the many myths that I think happened in the country is that we believe that teaching and learning are the same thing. And we in this country tend to, both as parents and as teachers, as faculty people, trust teaching and not learning. And I think that's a mistake.
Hold the meat in one hand. Mm-hmm. When you talk about learning, what's the process? When you talk about teaching, what's the process?
Well, teaching is the process of believing that one, what happens now is believing that one can, those who do not know what I know, I will tell them what I know.
Fill them up.
Yes, it's like a cup. That's exactly right. And you put layers of thinking. Now, that's not the way people learn. We can tell, babies don't sit down and you put layers. Babies come absolutely nude. They have no language, you know, or they don't have the language of the people around them. And you don't sit them down until they're 5 years old. But in that time, they have learned many things. Learning is a kind of, if you are in a community of learners, you will learn. Learning is something that happens. The human is set up to learn stuff.
Synthesis, process of synthesis.
Yes. And it's more than that. It's not just linear and rational. There are all kinds of ways that it happens. Some we understand and recognize, some we don't. But that doesn't turn off when you get five and go to schools. The linear rational way of knowing is the one that is validated by the academy. And I talked to my students and mentioned that that isn't the only way to know. But what happens is people begin to not value as much what they have learned because it is not validated by those who believe they can validate such things. I'm lucky I validate all my learning and even the things I've been taught. I think that's a mistake because it relegates to invalid things so much of what we are as humans. Since humans are more than their mind, it doesn't say the unexamined mind is not worth living. It is the unexamined life. And poetry, somebody asked me yesterday about poetry in terms of written language, as if poetry didn't begin with sound. It began coming out of the mouths of bards and poets. And the Academy, I'm always amazed at the Academy, which doesn't value oral poetry, for instance, and yet it teaches Beowulf. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were not, you know, people didn't sit around writing down these early things. They were spoken.
In the square to all the
people.
Yes,
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you write easily? Is poetry something that comes when you sit down to the page?
Well, when it does, doesn't always, you know. I do a lot in my head. My children are only 6.5 years apart in age, the oldest to the
All
youngest.
Six. Mm-hmm.
Right now, the ages of my kids, they're 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, and 32.
A rush of children.
I like to think, oh, that's a good way to think of it, a rush of children came to me. And so I had to learn how to do that and poetry at the same time. People ask me, what is the optimum circumstance under which to write? I think it's to have four kids and diapers at the same time, obviously, because that's what I did. But I learned how to do it because I had to do both things, and I'm very conscientious about my children. What I do tell students sometimes is that either or is not an African tradition. Both and is an African tradition. And of course one can do a lot at the same time. Now, with my kids, I learn to process a lot in my head so that by the time I go to a typewriter or a word processor, and I have always composed on a typewriter or a word processor, I cannot compose longhand. Instead of starting at A and going to Z, I'm starting at L and going to Z. So I've got a lot done in my head, and I learned how to do that and make dinner at the same time. It's worked out pretty well for me.
When you spoke, you quoted a man who I think's name was Richard Wilbur. Mm-hmm. There's always life or death. I had forgotten.
It's a poem called The Writer, a poem to his daughter. And she's trying to write and wants his help. And the final part of the poem is, it is always life or death as I had forgotten. And it is. Each poem, that's one of the quarrels I have with computers, or with one of the dangers of a computer, is that the sense of urgency that is necessary for me in writing is not there. You know you can always fix it. And the sense of urgency in poetry making, I think, is that each word has to be there or you will die. You know that it is tremendously important to be precise because you don't get another chance. And with computer, you know, I mean, it's quite clear that you have another chance. And you do the other way as well, but the sense of urgency can be missing if one isn't very careful.
This is Lucille Clifton. She is a writer of poetry with 7 books of poetry to her credit. The latest is called Quilting. Also a book of memoirs called Generations, we mentioned earlier, which is a delightful piece. And 21 children's books. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. I mentioned when we first began, and I want to make a switch here and talk about mm-hmm. children's literature if we can, that when people look at children's books, they say that they are or should be simple, mm-hmm. not given to complex thoughts. I take it from reading a couple of your books and scanning a good number of others. You don't agree with that.
No. Why underestimate children in that way? And what is uncomplicated about Sleeping Beauty or any of the classic? What is uncomplicated about that?
We're believing something that's not true,
Absolutely.
Simply not true.
I think so. I think it's part of mythology. Parents and people often think they want to protect children. And so they leave children floundering, trying to figure out the life that they see.
Because
trying
we don't
to understand
want to
because
about
we don't talk about it.
Death,
and
divorce.
So they, any of those things, yeah. or the complexities of their own lives. That it doesn't mean that you do a lot of convoluted ideas, but you can render most complex things in a simple way, I think, in a clear and direct way. It isn't as if children don't, you see, that the idea is that if I didn't teach them that, they don't know anything about it. And that's about teaching and learning as well. Children see us and learn all the time. And the idea that they won't know something we didn't tell them is ridiculous.
So if Grandma dies and I say to my son, she went away, I'm protecting myself more than
Absolutely.
I'm protecting the son.
Sure.
Because he's going to look for her to come back.
Sure. Right? I have a friend who said to her daughter, Grandpa went to the store. And after about a month, she said, look, what's he buying?
What's he buying?
This is ridiculous, you know. And that's silly. Yeah. It's we underestimate the fragility of children. We underestimate their ability to cope with things and to deal with them. And we also underestimate, you know, people talk to me a lot about the problem. Teachers come to me about the problems of multicultural children's literature and about how will I deal with, in my all-white classroom, how will I deal with introducing books that have multicultural characters?
Because?
Well, they think there'll be a problem of having the children in their classrooms understand a book that deals with native culture. These same teachers, read books about bears to their children. They read books that have animal characters. Now, if you can, if the children can relate to other species, I think, silly me, I think they can relate to children, to other children. And the harm that is done, I don't know about the classrooms of Alaska, but I do know that there must be Native Alaskan children in the classrooms. And if they do not see ever an image of themselves, harm is done. How can they believe anything valid about themselves in their own lives if all of the things of value shown them reflect somebody else? You know?
There is a... In reading reviews of some of your books, I came across what I think was an inadvertent racism, but it stuck out for me, and I wanted you to take a look at it for me. It was in 1976, a book called Three Wishes. And the writer said, too few children's books for blacks justify their ethnicity. But this one, Three Wishes, is a winning blend of black English and bright illustration. Written in 1976 for the New York Times Book Review. And when I read it, I was startled by it. Justify their ethnicity?
Isn't that amazing?
We don't justify the ethnicity of Scots or Germans or white folk.
Yeah. Why is it necessary? And I also am interested in the phrase books written for blacks, because they're books with black characters in them. Does this mean that the other ones are written for whites?
That's another thing I wondered about.
You know?
Where does this... It comes, I think, from the racism we can't get out of our bones, but where does this delicacy and inability just to deal come from, do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's so... I mean, I don't even think it's hostile. I think it's ignorant or innocent, one of those. Probably the ig one. But whatever, one has to ignore it, you know.
Is it one always has to ask, getting better? Are there more broader-based representation of the American people in more children's books?
There was for a while. I'm not sure there are as many now. And I think that it's a process that one, it's like inventing the wheel. You reinvent it every day. It's a process. Nowadays, I teach a course called Issues in Children's Literature. And while there are African-American kids in children's literature now, where are the Native American kids? They come to the first Thanksgiving in children's literature, and they don't like it, so they don't come back. That's the only thing I can figure. Where are the Chicano children? Where are the children who speak Spanish? And there are, you know, and it isn't as if these are the Spanish-speaking children are new people, new citizens. On the west coast of the lower 48, I heard this is my Alaska term. These people have been for generations and generations on this shore. Where are the not generic Asian children? You know, Asian children don't think they're Asian; they think they're Chinese and Japanese and Filipino and things. You have to every day work on it, and it's not something that we solve. There's a problem we solve, and we go on to something else. These are things we work on all the time. And we work on trying to be as sensitive as we can and trying to be people of good intent, which is all we can do. I would not think that, I get letters from children all the time. I mean, one of the good things about writing for kids is that you do get letters and then teachers assign you. So sometime in the spring I might get 40 letters from a little town in Iowa. I know what that is, you know. And the children, by and large, I can tell from the names, I can tell from where they're from, you can tell from all kinds of internal things that they are primarily white children. And they never see a problem and with the children and books that I write, and I do not write books. My books tend to be mostly black children, all black children, really, except for two. And these kids, after they see the illustrations, then they begin to see the circumstance, what's going on. And they are things that happen to all children. I hope that the books are about being a child. And all children, children who are poor and children who are not, go through a lot of the same kinds of inner lives. And I hope that, I'm sure of it, the children, when they write to me, talk to me about their inner lives as well, which are the same. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the fear that parents have is another false issue, from parents not understanding something about themselves and others, from parents believing that the outside of me has anything to do with the inside of me. Now, it does in a way. I have a history on this continent, which is different. And so I can see things from more than one perspective. I can see things, my point of view may be a bit differently. I may see things from a whole different angle. But that doesn't mean anything about my humanness, since all of us as humans wish not to be exploited, wish to be happy, wish to be loved, have fears, are sure that everybody notices that we don't know as much as we think we do, or we pretend to. You know, all of us have that.
Yeah.
And that's what where one's poetry comes from, and that's also where one's where children's books tend to come from, for me.
You're listening to Conversations. This is Lucille Clifton, a poet and a writer of children's books. You have a series of books that is about a little boy called Everett Anderson.
Yes.
There's seven books. We see Everett growing and changing, and mm-hmm. and both enduring and celebrating mm-hmm. many of the things, as you say, make us human. Mm-hmm. Where did Everett come from?
Well, I wanted to write about a little boy who was poor, and because I wanted to write about a child who was not poor in spirit, who didn't have things, but who was a loving child with joy in his life, and who lived with just his mother in a single-parent home in the projects. I lived in the projects at one time in my life. They are not an apartment building, trust me. You know, I always tell students, people who live in apartments don't want to move to the projects, but people in projects are kind of trying to get to an apartment. And I also wanted to write something about, one of my sons was six at the time, and I knew that quite well. And I wanted to write about a boy who was loved. And so I did, I think. And people introduce me now as Everett Anderson's mother. And he's my my seventh child.
What fun. We have three books with us here.
Well, this is the first one. Mm-hmm. Well, in each of the books, Everett Anderson's father is a present absence. I wanted to show that because parents break up, it doesn't have, sometimes children think it's their fault.
Yes.
And I wanted to show that Everett loves his father and his father probably loves him. That probably, I get more letters about that than almost anything. Because kids say, I'm just like Everett Anderson, my daddy's gone and this and that, you know.
And I love my dad.
Uh-huh. And he loves me. They talk about that. Children, when I go to conferences and things, children ask me, where is Everett Anderson's daddy? And they used to before the last one. I don't know. And we sort of are sad about it for a while. Everett Anderson's goodbye, his father dies. I wanted to write something about death that wasn't didactic, and I didn't know how to do it. It wasn't necessarily an Everett Anderson book. But then I thought, well, children know Everett's father, but not that well. And so this would be something that I would try to do. But the 9 month long is fun because Everett's mother has remarried and Everett hasn't thought that was the best thing that ever happened.
Who is this person
yes,
in my house?
And then his mother's Well, I'll do a couple from it. The second, and I rhyme. Everett Anderson's books are written in iambic pentameter verse. I don't think it's poetry. I think it's verse. I think it's good verse, but it's verse. And I always say I do that to prove that I know about rhyme, too. And Everett is talking, and each of the verses actually has his name in it, if you notice. Mama is smiling in a new way, and Mr. Perry is humming and humming, and Everett Anderson thinks that they act as if something special is coming. And then another. They live in 14A in the project. Something is growing in 14A. Something resting inside a place warm and soft. His mama's face is gentle. Everett likes to say that if he were a baby again, he'd start again just like that, near his mama's heart. Mrs. Perry is sitting and rocking these days, and Everett sits beside her and notices how his mama is smiling and singing and spreading wider and wider. And I like this one. Now, Everett has resented all this off and on. When we were just two, Everett Anderson frowns, Mama would play with me, and now she hardly can run or fly a kite and has to rest both day and night and hardly even spanks me now. It seems Mr. Perry's fault, somehow. I think that's great fun. But Mr. Perry talks to him. And the last is, and there was such conversation on the phone between the publisher and I, should this be a girl or a boy? I mean, I didn't worry about my own children this much. Ladies and gentlemen, hooray for us. With just a little bit of fuss, we would like to have all of you meet somebody brown and warm and sweet who has come to be part of our family, too. Baby Evelyn Perry says, how do you do? That was sort of fun.
Lucille Clifton reading from Everett Anderson's 9-month-long. You have in your children's books, and I think in your poetry too, worked to redefine words and
Absolutely.
Images.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a very important thing to be done for you.
Yes, oh yes. Well, the best example in the children's book is a book called Don't You Remember, where the little girl is talking about one of the things that she wants is a big, black, beautiful cake with Tate on it. Tate is her name, in pink letters. And because I trust learning. I tell my students all the time, I don't know if I can teach you anything, but I know you can learn. And they do. It's wonderful. I'm very grateful to them for that. I wanted to have the word black, which has been associated with such negative connotation in this country, surrounded by good imagery, by positive imagery, so that children who read that, somewhere in them, when they think black, they don't always think things of negativity. They think big and beautiful and cake and celebration. And I think that's an important doing.
It's a part of redefining. You also give us strong little black boys mm-hmm. and strong little girls mm-hmm. in your books. Is this part of that goal of continually reminding?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah. I think so. I trust that something stays with people. I try to give in poetry strong imagery of an idea of possibility for people of color, for women, for males who are also caught up in a mythology that has not served them well.
Who I am is who I should be.
Yeah. And that there is one way to be a man. That's ridiculous, you know. That there is one acceptable way to be female. That there is one thing that is African-American. That there is one thing. You know, instead of all of us having our scamps and our saints, I always say that I want the right to my own, I want the right to my rascals. Right. So that when I have friends who've said, I used to be liberal, but I was mugged by a black guy. So I'm not anymore. I mean, okay, you know. But there are people in my race that are not nice people. And there are people in your race that are not nice people. And you often cannot tell from the outside which is which. That's just the fact. And I want to remind people that that's so. I try to do that sometimes.
There is a book called, is it My Friend Jacob?
Mm-hmm.
Where did this book come from? And can you tell us the story? It's a lovely book.
Thank you. My Friend Jacob is about a boy who is a Downs child. And it's based on a child I knew. It's based on a child I knew that I love. He was a very good friend of ours and our families. And one day his mother, who was also a very good friend, said, you know, he was a Downs child. I feel very badly about his godmother because I've given her a defective child. And I thought, is there such a thing as a defective child? Mm. What a horrible thought. And so My Friend Jacob is about a little black boy and an older boy who is white and who has Down syndrome. Now that is, of course, that's purposeful. Of course it is. I am interested, and I have several books that the characters, two buddies, are of different races. And I would like, and I usually have, I think I always do, have the black one as the more active one. And that balances lots of things. And anyway, these two boys are great friends, and they each can do something. They know, one of them knows a certain kind of thing, and the other, no one is without any, well, some people are, but not as often as we think. And it's based on an incident where this boy, this friend of our family's, would walk into our house anytime. And my kid said to me one day, why do you let him do that? And I said, well, and they said, you say not to treat him differently, but you don't let us walk into anybody's house whenever. Huh. He has to learn to knock. And so I thought, yes, well, he does. And so we tried to get to teach him to knock, and he just wouldn't get it. You know, I mean, and because why should he? He was used to walking into the house. And one day, this is just what happened in the book. One day we were sitting at dinner and we heard this bang, bang, bang. And we looked up and he opened the door and said, I'm knocking. And it was such a proud moment. It was such a proud moment.
He'd gotten it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And we were very proud. And I think, I don't know if he did it that often after, but he had gotten it. And yet this child, I don't know how to drive. And so I don't know the name. I know a Volkswagen Bug when I see it. And I know a station wagon. That's about it. This child could tell a car at 50 paces. I mean, he knows every car going. So to me, that was exciting. He had knowledge that I don't. Mm-hmm. How could I call him defective? If I want a car, I have to ask him, you know? And I just wanted to show something that everybody has strengths, that everybody has something. And that book, I think, has been useful. People have used it in classes, special classes and that sort of thing. And it's just a sort of different way maybe to look at people, to know that everyone has a kind of strength. Everyone knows something.
You've mentioned several times that something has value or that something is useful. Is it important that things be put to use, that things move and change, give someone an opportunity to learn?
I think so, but I don't. I think maybe it isn't the definition of useful that is common, because something is useful if it is in the world as a positive force. You know. I think I would like to think of myself as useful as often as possible, but that doesn't mean I'm doing something. Do you know? Perhaps I'm being something, and perhaps that's useful. I notice that young poets think, or young writers often think, that if they're not sitting somewhere writing, they're not being writers. Yeah. And that seems to me a mistake, that in our culture we value physical doing, and there are other ways of being valuable. Babies are born valuable. People are valuable. Humanness is valuable.
Knowing the names of all the cars.
Life is valuable. Yeah. So I had some children once. I lived in a house that was near a stream, and two little boys were out in the back throwing rocks at two ducks that were in the stream. And I ran out and said, boys, don't throw rocks at those ducks. And they turned and said, why, lady? Because they didn't know. Yeah. They didn't understand that life is valuable. I think we live in a culture quite often where we do not value life unless it looks like ourselves. And that means that we don't value trees.
Ducks.
Ducks. Grass. you know, all things that live are kin. I have a poem that says that. And I think that's true.
Are you an optimist, do you think?
No. I like to think I'm a realist. I believe in possibility. I believe in the universe. I believe that humans aren't the standard by which things may be judged. An optimist may say that humans will be okay. I don't know about that. Hmm. But life will. I do know that. You know, I do know that. I think we are part of the whole. We are not it. We are part of it. And I think it's going to be fine. Now, maybe I am an optimist. I don't think so.
What moves you today, whether as a one who would write another children's book or one who will write her next poem?
Oh, it could be anything. I remain open to the world, and my writing is my response to the world, and the world keeps going, and so do I, so I'm always available to respond to it, I guess. I'm moved by injustice.
I'm wondering, in your 55th year, stuff.
Yeah.
What is
Well, actually, I'm moved by my 55th year. I'm thinking of trying to write some poems from a woman of my age. I don't know if that has been really written about in poetry well. A woman who is alive and who is who inside herself thinks she's 26. You know,
yes.
I'm not sure that that's been written about. At any rate, I might try to do that. How does one treat women who appear to be, who seem to, it seems that they ought to get out of the way now, but they don't, you know? If we're not careful, we'll get out of the way because it looks as if we're supposed to in this culture, which is a culture of youth. I'm not going to get out of the way, and I think I'll write about that.
There are cultures still existing on this earth where elders are valued for their accumulation of life and of wisdom. It's an obvious question, but I don't know that the answer is obvious, always obvious. What do we miss in this culture, do you think, by not transforming women of 55, 65, men of 70 into our elders, with all that that means?
Well, you know, we miss a lot of things, but I think that's an interesting idea because I wonder inside oneself, does one think of oneself as an elder? Hmm. I think that it may be, and I'm just speculating off the top of my head, but it may be that in cultures where one is revered as an elder, there's a point where one says, okay, I'll be an elder.
I am a poet.
You know, I'm
as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I'm a whole person, physically unable to do some of the things that I could do at 25. Physically probably better able to do some of the other ones, you know. I don't know if inside ourselves we define ourselves according to our age as much as one might think. It's an interesting question. And poetry is about questions.
Yes.
You know, when we revere elders, do we revere them as whole humans, or do we revere them as elders? And then do they become that for us? Do you know? We don't revere children in this culture very much. If we did, we wouldn't have such a high mortality rate of infant births. In industrialized world, why aren't we first? Mm. Why are we so low in healthy births? Maybe we should do that some. Maybe we should revere children some.
There seems to be a need, I think, just to revere.
Yes, that's the bottom line. Yeah. We should revere it all, including elders, including.
Will, do you think your great-great-grandmother, Caroline Donald, and your father and your mother will come to us again in your writing?
My poor mother will, because I have a poem, I worry her bones. Poor woman, I'm sure she thinks, leave me alone. I would think so. I don't know if I have explored too much that. My great Carolyn Donald's daughter, whose name was Lucille, I was named for her. And so I'm sure that that connection will come again.
Was it she who was the first?
She was
black woman.
First black woman legally hanged in Virginia.
For?
She killed the father of her son. The father of her son was a carpetbagger, came from Connecticut.
White man.
White man. And when the child was less than a year old, she killed him and was hanged. And I imagine I have not written all that wants to be said yet about any of them or any of the peoples in my head.
Do you feel like George Bernard Shaw, who you quoted, kicking ideas out
of
the way in the morning?
Yeah, people ask, where do you get ideas? He said, I get up in the morning, I have to kick them out of the way. I suppose there's so much to examine in the world. It is an interesting, interesting place. Being alive is an interesting, interesting thing. Don't you think?
Very much so.
I do, too.
May it be long. Lucille Clifton, thank you. This has been Conversations. We've been talking with poet and children's book writer Lucille Clifton. I'm Susan McGinnis, and I hope you'll join me again next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.